This is an LA Times Studios podcast.
Hello and welcome to LA Crimes. I'm your host, Madison McGee. On today's show, our first ever episode, we will be discussing one of America's biggest murder cases, the Menendez brothers. Later on the show, we'll have LA Times reporter Richard Winton to update us on why the decades-old murder is back in the news and whether the brothers have any kind of shot at freedom. But before we go any further, I want to introduce you to today's guest, Dateline correspondent Josh Mankiewicz. Josh, thanks for joining me.
Hi, Madison.
Hi. Because this is the first episode, I kind of want to talk to you about your true crime origin story. So we're going to call this segment the Gateway Case. You've been a Dateline correspondent for a long time.
30 years.
Yes. I didn't want to age you, but...
It's fine.
That's okay. Was that always your intention for your career?
It wasn't. I was a political reporter for most of my career. I covered the U.S. House, and I covered a lot of presidential campaigns, and I covered politics in New York, D.C., and Los Angeles in local news. But when I came to Dateline in 1995, for the first 10 years, we did all kinds of stories. About 2005, we started the turn to true crime, which I thought, I don't know if I really want to do this, like full time. But I did a story out of Reno, which was about the disappearance and then subsequent murder. But first, it was just a disappearance of a young woman named Brianna Dennison. And it was a story that sort of captivated a lot of people in Reno. And it touched on a lot of different topics, which we're still talking about today. And I did that for Dateline. And then we did it again after she'd been found. And then we did the story of her murder after doing the story of her disappearance. And I'm still in touch with her mom all these years later. And so that story had a big impact on me. Then in 2007, I did a story that for Dateline that sort of helped begin a discussion that's still going on today, which is on television, we don't cover missing black people the way we cover missing white people, particularly white women. Because if you watch television in the United States, certainly during the early part of this century, you would get the feeling that the only people who were missing were white, blonde, attractive females, which of course wasn't true. So I did a story about that in 2005. I said 2007, but I think it was 2005 that we did that. So that's a discussion that's been going on for 20 years. I didn't think that it would still be going on, but it is.
Yeah, wow. Well, I mean, it also sounds like there's like a crossover of like true crime is in a way political.
Well, if you're going to tell me, you know, I mean, I switched from politics to crime, but if you're going to tell me that the way the criminal justice system operates, the differences between justice for, people of color and people who have money people who live in certain areas and people who are missing and people who are murdered. If you're going to tell me that's not part of our politics, I'll tell you, you're crazy.
What was it like going from covering politics, which feels sort of like, I mean, you're covering wealthy white men particularly, to then having to cover a case about a missing woman, and the tone and the empathy shifts a little bit in that style of reporting?
It does. I mean, one of the things that is that's unfortunate about covering crime is that you can't have as much fun with it as you do when you're covering politics. Like it's fine to make fun of politicians when you're covering them. And in fact, you can adopt a kind of a, you know, arch, sarcastic view of them the way a lot of columnists do. You can't have that kind of fun covering a murder. You can have a little fun with the storytelling. That is to say, the leading the audience around corners that we do on Dateline and not revealing everything right away all at once at the top of the story. But the story itself, the murder, there's nothing funny about that. It is the most serious and most awful thing that's ever happened to those people. And it's a huge responsibility to be telling that story. Murder is a wrecking ball. And I don't need to tell you that. And it splits people's lives in two, before and after. And the idea that there's something called closure, or that somebody's life can be repaired or put back the way it was by something the criminal justice system does, is a pleasant fantasy, but it's a fantasy. And so you talk to people who have had the worst thing that ever happened to them happen, and then they're talking to you about it. So it's a lot sometimes.
Yeah, so you're no stranger to my situation, but I am investigating my dad's murder, and it's a cold case from Ohio, arguably one of the worst states to have a cold case out of. And it is exactly what you're describing as far as a case that just doesn't get a lot of attention or traction. And any sort of negligence or the case not getting solved is completely overlooked because it doesn't matter. I actually had someone that I spoke to recently, a former FBI agent, said that they call those internally misdemeanor murders, people who no one would really care if they get killed.
And calling it a misdemeanor because of the line of work that your dad was involved in at the time.
Correct. Yeah, my dad being a drug dealer turned confidential informant, you know, they don't really feel the need to look into or prosecute anyone because in their mind, it's almost convenient for them that another drug dealer is dead.
Because if this were the mayor's daughter who was killed and it was still a cold case, there'd be a lot more people working on it.
Oh, I mean, it would probably wouldn't even get to that point ever, right? There's no way that anyone of that sort of status in society's case would be cold for 20 plus years with very little police involvement. And it's very interesting now to in this world that I'm in to see people who are incredible journalists, who have really high journalistic integrity, who just can't cover every case, obviously. So I took it upon myself to investigate my dad's case, and it illuminated a lot of things, but also sparked this interest for me in this side of the industry, journalism, investigating. And now I'm interested in all of the other people who are ignored too.
And you get a sense of how many people out there never got any answers, didn't have the resources or the time or the ability to investigate it themselves, or didn't get anywhere. And it's, you know, their file is in some police property room somewhere in America. And with each week that goes by, the chance that it's going to get solved gets a little smaller. And there's a sense of hopelessness that people feel. And it's at variance with the way that we are always taught that the criminal justice system operates, because the people are represented by two separate yet equally important groups, the police who investigate crime and the district attorneys who prosecute the offenders. That's the beginning of law and order, right? That's how a lot of people think this works. That isn't how it works a lot of the time.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's so many examples of this I'm diving into right now of just – it's countless. You could spend 5 minutes and you'd find 100 examples of where these systems are not protecting people. And it's hard because you want to jump in to help. And in a way, I mean, you are and I am in some way, but these stories become so public, and then it also alters the way that they're covered and then the way that they're perceived by other people and the aftermath and potentially what ends up happening in court is impacted by what people think about it. The court of public opinion has a lot more power, I think, than we realize or we allow it to, but it's kind of scary. Do you ever feel like you have like a weight of responsibility because you're putting a case on Dateline and a lot of your cases are going through
totally
trial when they're airing?
Totally, we do. I mean, as I said, this is a very big responsibility to the family involved. Also, frequently to the people who worked on the story. I mean, we cover mostly stories in which the criminal justice system operated well. You know, most of the stories we cover are ones in which the police solved the murder. the prosecutors prosecuted the right person, and then there was a verdict by a jury, which was either, you know, guilty or not guilty. We never know how that's going to come out. So, you know, you owe a duty to the hard work that was done by those people when they do a great job, which frequently they do. So there's that. There's also the message that you're sending to everybody else about what stories count. You know, I mean, you know, that famous line by Michael Connelly, everybody counts or nobody counts. That's true. He's right.
We're going to talk a lot more about TV and true crime in just a minute, but first, a quick break. Welcome back to LA Crimes. I'm joined by Josh Mankiewicz, a correspondent from Dateline. Coming up, we'll speak with LA Times reporter Richard Witten about updates to the Menendez brothers' case. Josh, I don't want to get too ahead of myself, but part of why this case has become so popular again is because of some TV programs about it that you really can't escape. And you are not new to this phenomenon of television impacting or bringing back old cases or cold cases into the public sphere. And that brings us very nicely into my next segment, TV and true crime. Do you have any examples of cases that you've covered that that's happened with or stories that you've seen?
Yeah, I ended up doing a Dateline piece about the Tiger King case because of the charges that now we're in the weeds, that he made about Carol.
Right.
Which the popularity of the Tiger King documentary and the Menendez documentary drove the coverage. There's no question the coverage drove people in the criminal justice system to reevaluate those cases, or certainly in the Menendez case to reevaluate that. You will not convince me that the DA Gascon was not looking for votes when he started talking about maybe changing their sentence right before he was up for reelection. So it's a wind that sort of blows back on itself, and that happens all the time. There's no question about it.
Yeah, it's really interesting because I think a lot of people who are in those situations, I'm friends with people who have been involved in cases that got a lot of public attention. Sometimes they don't really like the attention because it brings up a lot of hard feelings and negative feelings. But then in my case, oh, that's all I want, or I think I want, right? And so it's this weird line of the attention can really help a case, but the impact it has can be the opposite.
This is something that's come up fairly recently with me. You want the attention. But that's because your case hasn't been solved yet. Now, let's say, as I expect, you do end up solving that case. And then you're on Dateline. And then, as I also expect, Alicia Vikander plays you in the movies. And I get to go to the premiere with you. I've thought about all of this. Then you go on to something else. Some other case or some other story or some other career entirely. We don't know. But in 5 years, some cable network calls you and says, we're doing a story about your father and you, and we want you to cooperate. And you say, I'm kind of past that, and we solved it, and I've dealt with it, and I don't want to do it anymore. And they say, fine, we'll do it without you. And so then they do it without you, and they hire a stand-in to play young Madison and then another one to play older Madison, right? And then it comes out and you think, that was terrible, right? And I feel kind of a little victimized by that. That's something that families in the world of true crime have felt. And I've talked to a couple of them about it, which is, and they've said to me, I loved being on Dateline and it really helped us. Right? And you guys were great with us. The trailing edge of true crime, the people who pick up the story 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 years later and want to do it, and they don't operate under the same journalistic strictures that we do. I cannot say on Dateline that somebody was a suspect if they weren't a suspect. And if I say that, then I later have to say, and John Smith was later released from custody and police never filed any charges and they realized he'd been somewhere else at the time of the murder. I mean, we need to, if we make somebody a suspect on Dateline, we also are careful to exonerate them or at least say what did eventually happen with that. But other people are not under those requirements because they don't consider themselves journalists. They consider themselves filmmakers or documentarians, and they're in a different world than we are.
Yeah. I think, yeah, it's this weird line between journalistic integrity, which in my mind, like a Dateline and LA Times, like these bigger news organizations have, is very different from like entertainment. And I think that line to a consumer is becoming thinner and thinner.
I think it's becoming nearly invisible. I mean, I'd be kidding myself if I told you that people perceive, you know, the stories that Dateline has done on the Menendez case, which were done not by me but by Keith Morrison, and the documentary, that they perceive them as being sort of held to different journalistic standards. I don't think people think about that at all. They think of them as being two versions of the same story, and they have equal weight in their minds.
Yeah. And even, you know, the Ryan Murphy show. Like, that's a scripted show. And, right. You know, you see it at the very beginning of any scripted show, like, based on a true story. So you already have this sort of disclaimer that details could have been shuffled or changed to make this more exciting for TV. And I think people probably watch this show and then read an article about the Menendez brothers and think that that's the same.
So I was doing a story once that we had found out about, that Dateline had, you know, we get stories from all over the place. I mean, we're reading the paper every day all over the country and local stations now, because we've been doing this for so long, they call us, and police departments and prosecutors that we've worked with in the past, and certainly reporters around the country say, this is, we don't know, I don't know how this is going to come out, but this looks like the kind of thing you guys are going to want to do. So we find a story, we heard about a story because it had run on some very obscure cable network, not one of the ones that you think about when you think about true crime. I can't remember which one it was. And so we got it from there, and I saw their take on the story. And so then we go book some people and we're interviewing them. And I'm interviewing the prosecutor, and I say, so tell me about, you know, these other suspects, because there was a time when you didn't believe it was this guy. You thought it was these other people. And she goes, oh, you saw that show on, and then she named the cable network, which I can't remember what it was. And I'm like, yeah. She goes, yeah, they made that up. There weren't any other suspects. She goes, I don't know where that came from. We were only looking at Mr. Smith, and there was never anybody else. But they put that in to make it seem like there was, you know, some back and forth, some zigzag to the investigation. And I thought to myself, oh, my God, we should not even be in this room right now.
Yeah, I mean, we could talk a little bit about, I think about this a lot with, like, justified killings and all of this stuff. You know, it's very prevalent with, like, the Gypsy Rose thing. I mean, there's a lot of cases like this where it's, like, should, to me, they killed someone. They killed two people. And I think that there still should be justice for that. And I feel like the idea that now we've sort of rested the morality of murder in the hands of TikTok because of a television show feels very weird to me. But this is like, it's not just this case. There's other cases where this is happening. And it's a very weird situation for me, because even I see it in my reviews on my podcast, like, oh, well, your dad was a drug dealer. Of course he got killed. And it's like, why are we like setting the idea of morality behind murder in the hands of like random people who just have opinions?
You know, look, our attention span as a nation, as a people, has diminished significantly. And that's affecting everything from our politics to things like, you know, is someone guilty of a crime? What punishment do they deserve as a result? And I don't see that changing except maybe for the worse.
Yeah. And not that I think our system is perfect, but it is interesting that we think now, like, we can just get on Reddit and decide whether or not someone deserved to be murdered or not. That seems very...
It is astonishing that people who have seen a TV show and think that now they understand the case. It's probably a mistake to look at any one program and make your decisions about how the legal system should react and should punish the people in that based on seeing one 60-minute or 120-minute program. There's always going to be some nuance. People like black and white, you know? People like that. People like a clear choice. The problem is, particularly when it comes to crime or when it comes to murder or when it comes to cold cases, like it's all one big gray blur sometimes.
After the break, we'll get the scoop on the Menendez brothers from LA Times reporter Richard Winton.
Ever wonder where your water comes from? What it really means to break up with fossil fuels? Or what life might look like in the year 2100? Our friends at the Sierra Club Angeles Chapter, in collaboration with Stranded Astronaut Productions, dive into those questions and more in a new podcast called The Climate Dispatch. Hosted by Taya Jeanette, the show brings together voices from across the climate movement to share stories, fears, and hopes for the future, all through the lens of Southern California. Guests include Nayeli Kobo, Tori Stevens, Aru Shinya Jay, and Allison Chin. Plus, each episode features music from a local LA band. Listen to The Climate Dispatch at sc.org/climatedispatch or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everyone. Just before we jump into my interview with Richard Winton, I have my producer, Mary Knopf, here because last week there was a big update in the Menendez brothers case.
Yeah, I guess the courts don't care about our podcast and they're not going to wait.
Everything happened really like it feels like lightning speed. But the Menendez brothers were resentenced from life, no possibility of parole, to 50 years to life with possibility of parole. And now they're eligible for parole, even though they've only served for 35 years.
So listeners, the interview with Richard happened before this past resentencing hearing, but it's still a really fun conversation. And Madison, maybe you agree with me or disagree with me, but I feel like you all talk about, like, the future of the Menendez brothers is still uncertain, I think, even
yeah,
though—
Yeah, we talk a lot about the future of the brothers, but also sort of the, like, implications— in a grander way in, like, the criminal justice system. And, like, you know, they still could go through, like, a clemency process. So there's like, a lot. Just because their sentence was reduced doesn't really change sort of what's happened because of this case and, like, the public perception and what that has sparked and the greater conversation that that's created.
And, yeah, like you said, there was no acquittal. I think in order for them to even really— get this. They both, you know, I think zoomed into court remotely and had to basically they admitted, like, we should have never killed. They admitted to the crimes of killing their parents. Because I think that's a pretty key part to parole and what a parole board likes to hear is they want you to admit to what you've done.
You're not getting paroled if you're still in jail going, I didn't do it, I didn't
exactly.
do it.
Exactly. Yeah. And Nathan Hochman, the DA, is especially, he's like zeroed in on that, where they keep lying and deflecting and all of this stuff. So for the two of them to admit that they killed their parents and that they feel bad about it.
This interview is so interesting to me too, because I think it illuminates a lot of the details of the case that aren't discussed. And so, you know, now we sort of know, I think a lot of people are questioning why still the 50-year sentence. And I think this interview will kind of illuminate why they're still sort of coming down on them a little harshly instead of just saying, like, time served or anything like that, because of a lot of the details that Richard has been, who's been studying this case, obviously, so in depth, really highlights. And I think that is what I didn't know a lot of those details, and I think a lot of people who are getting these very quick bites about this case don't know.
Yeah. Madison, I think that tees us up for your combo.
Yeah, and here it is, my conversation with Richard Winton and Josh Mankiewicz. Welcome back to LA Crimes. Today's guest is Josh Mankiewicz, but now we're joined in studio with LA Times reporter Richard Winton. Richard, thank you so much for being here.
Nice to be here, as always.
So we're talking about the Menendez brothers today, and they murdered their parents in 1989, but now they're all over the news. Can you explain a little bit of, like, what's going on? Catch us up to speed.
Well, basically, we have the legal issues, and then we also have all the drama around documentaries and TV shows on Netflix. But essentially, yes, we have a vintage murder, which is now a vintage murder in Los Angeles, which is now back in the spotlight because of court proceedings. We basically have here, they have an effort to get a new trial, an effort to get resentenced potentially, and even an effort for clemency from Governor Gavin Newsom. At the same time, there's a documentary on them, very detailed documentary, laying out the case, the drama, their allegations of sexual abuse. And then we've also got a real drama version of their lives with, you know, uses the word, you know, monsters right there in the title. It kind of spells out things. And so we've got reintroducing a crime, which if you've lived in Los Angeles a long time, you're familiar with. But if you're younger, this was all new information. And that's what's kind of led to where we are today.
There's this talk of new evidence. Can you speak on that a little bit and why that wasn't presented earlier and what sort of sparked this conversation of new evidence in relation to this case?
About a year and a half ago, they filed a motion basically saying, hey, we got new evidence. And the new evidence was that one of the brothers sent their cousin a letter essentially saying, I'm being sexually abused. And this is back in the 1980s.
Before the crime.
Before the crime. This letter wasn't in the original evidence. They had two very extensive trials, and this was never presented. In addition, we now also have another abuse victim. A member of Menudo came forward. The father had managed and overseen the record label they were on and said he too was sexually abused as a young man. And so this is the new evidence which they were seeking to have a new trial from. But there's also a lot more going on here than that. And there may be even quicker routes because new trial really is not what they want after 35 years. They want to either be resentenced or just be let out.
So where does DA Nathan Hochman stand on this? Because he's obviously a really important player in this to make this decision on how to proceed moving forward.
Well, what we've seen is a dramatic change in direction here. So we had a DA until the election in November, George Gascon, who was favoring resentencing them. Their current sentence is life without parole. That means they can't get out, period. Gascon proposed, okay, let's have a resentencing, which would be essentially life, which would be give them an opportunity to get parole. As they're youthful, they were under 26, they're what they call youthful offenders in California, they would be eligible. And that would be a really strong chance they would get out of. Mr. Hochman, shortly after becoming DA, made it quite clear. Firstly, he opposed the habeas, saying, this is not new evidence. Sexual abuse isn't the crime. The crime here is a murder, and there wasn't an immediate threat to their parents. They just went out, surreptitiously bought shotguns, came home and shot their parents.
And whatever this new evidence is, whether you believe that letter or not, it has nothing to do with what happened in the home that day, of what they are accused of doing. That's his point.
I think Nathan Hochman, however, has studied the case in great detail. It's rare for you to see a top the DA themselves be able to give you just minutiae and detail of the case like he has done in the last few weeks, like stood up there for like well over a couple of hours just talking about it and laying out every single fact in the case and sort of re-prosecuting the case, literally. So he's like making it clear he does not support resentencing.
You know, and I mean, none of that, I think, should come as an enormous shock. I mean, this guy was elected, Mr. Hochman, clearly with sort of this get tough on crime platform and talking about bringing back the death penalty in some limited circumstances and sort of going the opposite way on Menendez, it certainly fits with what he said he was going to do. I mean, he didn't specifically talk about Menendez during the election, I don't think, but it certainly is in keeping with what he said he would do if he was elected DA.
How does that impact your approach to stories when you're covering a case? I mean, you have the internet sort of playing like they're a character now in these stories of bringing back attention. People are now running on promises to probably play towards this younger audience of people who think that they should be let out or whatever. And when you're covering a case like this, how does that impact your reporting?
I mean, a lot of our cases we cover in the criminal justice system are sort of only known by the people who are like in the room or like very much involved. But here, the knowledge and people understanding of it is great. When you have a show on Netflix just literally dramatizing the whole crime, there's going to be a massive saturation of information by comparison. But, you know, how saturated was the information? The governor went on his own on a podcast in Oakland and actually brought up his kids have watched this and were talking to him about it. And that's why he started talking about the clemency issue, because it's actually his kids who said, hey, have you seen this, Dad?
So that really leads into my next question. How is Gavin Newsom really involved in this case? And we sort of know now the origin of that. But what is he really talking about in relation to the Menendez brothers right now? And what do you think is going to happen there?
Well, interestingly, he's the governor of California. And someone in their situation, he can grant them clemency today. But what he's chosen to do here is actually created a whole new process. He said, well, I'm going to have parole agents basically look into their background, how they've done in prison, and create an assessment within like 3 months, basically of how they behaved, and then provide that to me so I can make a clemency decision. This is a whole new process. In fact, I was talking to a prosecutor yesterday who told me this doesn't just impact the Menendez case. This will now impact almost everyone else in their scenario. Because there's going to be now these assessments going on of people doing life and whether the government wants to reconsider, especially people who've done a lot of time. And one of the big X factors, I think, in this case is you have to remember they have been in 35 years.
Yeah, they've served a lot of time.
I guess the big question is how can we get Governor Newsom's kids to watch a documentary about high-speed rail?
That's a greater crime, though.
That's so funny. I have no words. I think one of the most interesting things about this case is no one is denying that anyone was killed by the Menendez brothers. Like, they have admitted to shooting and killing their parents. But can you walk me through sort of just an overview of the case in general and what the motive was in 1989 versus sort of what people are saying it is now and why that makes it different?
Okay, so basically they lived in this big mansion in Beverly Hills, you know, stereotypical giant mansion. And Kitty and Jose Menendez lived there. Jose is this massive, powerful music executive, tall back in the day. He's maniacal. He's so bad, in fact, when prosecutors put on their original case, they couldn't get anyone to go on the witness stand to say he was a nice guy. I mean, there's not much doubt about what they did. At the time, prosecutors' financial motive? Oh, yeah. Well, you have to remember, there's some interesting facts. You know, after their parents die, their grieving involved buying a Porsche, Rolex watches, and you guessed it, they bought it. So obviously, prosecutors went to trial twice, pushed the financial motive. The sexual abuse defense. In the first trial, which was a hung jury, it was very much front and center. Leslie Abrams made this all about that. The problem was even Leslie was aware that you have to have an immediate threat. So the idea throughout both trials, and it remains, is that their parents were eventually going to have to kill them to cover this all up. And so that's what they was claimed was their immediate fear, that their father would perpetrate their deaths, so they had to kill it first. They say Kitty knew about it, so they killed her too. She was part of the cover-up. In fact, at the recent hearing we just had, where two of the sisters of both the parents testified, one of the sisters testified that, yeah, her sister knew, as horrible as it is, now it's come to realization that her sister knew, And it actually, you know, not reported this, you know, helped cover it up.
Generally speaking, who do you find is supporting these brothers and who's opposing them? Because it doesn't feel like anyone is in the middle right now in their thoughts. It's they did it for the right reasons or they did it for the wrong reasons. And do you find that there's like a really strong divide between like, is it generational? Like, what's the divide here?
Generational seems to be a big divide. There's also political. I mean, clearly, you know, we saw the political divide reflects the George Gascon, very liberal prosecutor, reform-minded. They tend to fall into – that's where he get younger. That's where the people tend to be the ones who think most positively of the Menendezes.
Yeah. To me, the divide is a degree of knowledge about the case because the more research you do on it, the more likely you're going to change your opinion. If you watch a couple of TikTok videos, you may think one thing. You spend a couple of days reading some things, you may feel differently.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought actually the Hochman, when if you really want some education on this, it is good to listen to everything Hochman said in the lengthy statement because it does lay out at least his side of the table in great detail. I mean, he goes over very much the sort of the overwhelming problem is you come to after if you examine this a lot is, well, what was their immediate fear?
Let's take a listen to what Hochman had to say.
Now, during these killings, as we've explained before, these weren't just a situation where all of a sudden the parents threatened their lives, they reached for something and shot them dead. No. These killings, the actual shots, were designed to make it look like a mafia gangland hit. They shot Jose Menendez through the back of his head. They shot Kitty Menendez not only once, which then caused her to go down to the ground bleeding, but when they ran out of ammunition, they went back to the car, reloaded the shotgun. Then Lyle Menendez took the shotgun, put it up to Kitty Menendez's face, and pulled the trigger, again, to make it look like a gangland shooting, but that was not enough. They then, while they were dead, shot them in the kneecaps to make it, to complete the picture of what a gangland shooting would be.
So, Richard, what do you think is on the horizon for this case?
Well, there's going to be a hearing. I tend to think the judge is leaning towards doing a resentencing just because he's already let the two sisters of the deceased testify. I don't know if he'll completely ignore Hochman, but I think we're going to see the ball move some. And even if that doesn't happen, then Newsom's going to take a swing at the bat now. And we're going to see what he does next. It's surprising how many people actually want to get involved in this case. Because, yeah, this case dates from a long time ago.
Yeah, and it feels like, I mean, with the two sides of opinions on this, it feels like you're taking pretty bold moves as a politician sort of making such a strong stance because then you're ostracizing, you know, one side of this completely.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty surprising that Newsom, who has massive political ambitions at the presidential level, would want to inject himself into a case where two brothers basically wantonly slaughtered their parents with shotguns, including finishing their mama off after reloading. It's not exactly the kind of thing you want in a future campaign ad.
Yeah, well, it'll make your job really interesting for a while.
Oh, all these cases make it interesting. This is the hellscape we call Los Angeles justice.
Richard, Josh, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's it for LA Crimes. I'll see you next week. Thanks for listening to LA Crimes. If you'd like to hear more, please, please, please purchase a subscription to the LA Times podcast feed. You'll unlock weekly bonus episodes and you'll be supporting the award-winning journalists of the LA Times. It's the best way to support the show. LA Crimes is hosted by me, Madison McGee. It's produced by Mary Knopf and Jonathan Shiflett of Studio Phonic. Our video editor is Cooper Kenward. Our associate producer is Jordan Patterson. Our video director is Julia McCabe. Our director of post-production is Patrick Stewart. And our senior sound recording engineer is Nick Norton. Ben Church is our senior coordinating producer, and Anne-Marie Hauser is our production manager. Our podcast marketing manager is Bryn Jura, and our product marketing director is Becca Dorman. Special thanks to LA Times Studios president, Anna Migzanian, president and chief operating officer of the Los Angeles Times, Chris Argentieri, and executive editor of the Los Angeles Times, Terry Tang. LA Crimes is executive produced and created by Darius Derrickshawn.